We're back at the Radio Cafe. I'm Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte this morning. My next guest is Joanna Harcourt Smith. She's the author of Tripping the Bardo with Timothy Leary, a memoir of her relationship with Leary. And Joanna's going to do a performance and book signing Saturday night at Iconic Coffee Shop on Lena Street. There is a fee, I will mention, for that, but it includes a copy of the book, and you can go online, right, to your website, www.futureprimitive.org. That's Joanna's website if you want some more information about that talk. Welcome, Joanna.
Thank you so much for having me, Hollis.
This book has been a long time in the making.
You know, the book has been a long time in the making because I needed to have an overview and a deep understanding and possibly a compassionate understanding of myself at that very young age, and also of what we went through as a generation. Although I only speak about that in the introduction, it was very important to me to have composted both the historical level and the personal level of trauma and ingenuity.
Yeah,
of those times.
I love that, your use of the word composted. I'm going to borrow that, composting my own life. The book, much of the book, recounts, I'm not sure how many years it covers altogether. It sort of goes back and forth from early in your life and to this period of time that you knew and were in relationship with Timothy Leary. But basically it's a chronicle of drug abuse, alcoholism, promiscuous sex, you could call it promiscuous sex, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And I wonder now, looking back at that, how do you see that?
Well, I wanted to give a voice to this young woman because I think that a lot of people of my generation went through the same thing, looking for love in all the wrong places, in a rebellion that I really approve of, because just before us was the Second World War, the First World War. There was an enormous amount of brutality, and we were, in a certain sense, redefining what love meant to us, and in so doing made a lot of mistakes. But it was very brave as an explorer to ask so many questions, no matter if I had to fall low to pick myself up to go back and see what a beautiful light looks like.
It's interesting, and I think that's a great perspective that we could all borrow to have on our young lives, because so often we look back and we're angry at ourselves or shamed. And to be able to look back, as you said, at that little girl, that young woman you were, who was so unformed and so influenced by the context of her life. Tell the audience a little bit about your background.
I will. I do want to say that, you know, it's really about my relationship with this young woman and how I came to a great place of tenderness for her and really embracing her and understanding that she was really a stranger in a strange land. Mm-hmm. I was born into a Jewish family whose family had been almost exterminated. I say that my mother, even that she survived the Holocaust, she, feeling-wise, she was dead before I was born. Mm. And in a certain sense, I had to mother her. And I kept thinking, there must be more to this, there must be more to this than this fear of extinction, there must be more than objects consoling people from not having feelings. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that at a very young age that I really wanted to know what it is to be a human being.
So you were, you just self-describe yourself as a jet setter and a socialite from a social family, so to speak. And so you traveled all over the world. You spoke five or six languages.
I do.
You do still. That
still
doesn't
do.
Leave you.
Yes.
And you seem to be in search of the man that would rescue you, in that sense that women of that era defined themselves by the man they were with.
Absolutely. I mean, it was there were very little alternatives to that. But what it was really is that I was born to be an explorer, and I was told that the entire Earth had been discovered. And I wanted to discover the territory that had not been discovered, and I understood that it was the territory of our own mind, the territory of our heart, the territory of relationship, and this man seemed to be being the Pied Piper of that generation. He seemed to be a good person to ask, well, what is going on? Who are we? Where are we going?
Explain about how you met Timothy Leary and how you knew that he was your soulmate in some ways.
Well, you know, I'm fond of saying that my life has a life of its own.
Yes.
Because I've learned that much of life is surrendering to what wants to happen. So my finding Timothy Leary was a total series of synchronicities. And it's a very, very funny story, and I highly suggest that you read it, because it's amazing how the pieces of the puzzle came together, which brought us to be in Afghanistan. He was a fugitive from prison. In those days, people were given 10-year and 15-year prison sentences for possession of one joint, one little bit of marijuana, and he had been put in prison as a scapegoat, as an example, and he had escaped from prison. This was 1969, and he was in Switzerland, and he and I met in Switzerland. I was 26, he was 53. I had found my outlaw, my Robin Hood, the person who would answer all my questions, and we traveled to Afghanistan, and there we were literally captured, and that's a very, very interesting...
Interesting and complex. Very complex.
Thank you,
yes.
Alice, absolutely.
And the period of time that you and Timothy were actually together in relationship before he was put in prison again was actually quite small.
It was very small. It was 6 weeks of time.
49 days.
49 days, exactly. That's why I call it the bardo. It is at that time that I died, and then during the 3.5 years he was moved from prison to prison in a very complex political time. I accompanied him by visiting him almost every day in these prisons and learning what the epoch was about, what the counterculture was about, what his story was, which is an interesting story, I must say.
And so I'm not sure there's anyone out there who doesn't know this, but Timothy Leary was a Harvard professor, a psychologist, a very well-known, well-respected person in his field, and he did a series of experiments with LSD before anyone knew what LSD was, and in terms of psychological experiments, that is, and then ultimately the government came to the conclusion that LSD was a dangerous substance, and he did become, in essence, as you said, the scapegoat of the counterculture based on his association with LSD, and his life took a very abrupt turn in a different direction. But tell me, how did he fulfill or not fulfill your fantasy of what he was going to offer you?
Well, you see, there are three parts to this story. There is my willingness to bring back this young woman and show what she went through by her own innocence. Every bit of depravity that I describe really comes from innocence and misunderstanding of oneself. And then there's the political story, which I couldn't fathom for a second, being a debutante in Europe. And then there's the woman's story, the fact that I evolved so much as a woman, because this absolutely took me to a bottoming out where I understood that a woman is not defined by a man. Mm. And that's been an enormous evolution for myself, and I think for many other women of that time. Mm-hmm. And often a lot of suffering comes with giving birth to yourself as a real individual and yet interbeinged human being.
Yeah. So how did Timothy Leary meet your expectations, and how did he not in that relationship?
Well, very simply, I love intelligence. I'm fascinated by intelligence, and he was definitely incredibly brilliant. But intelligence is just the words to the song. And he just didn't have, for me, he didn't have the music. Once again, repeating my mother's, He didn't have the music of the feelings that make the words so powerful. So in that way, in the way of being kind and feeling and understanding that we are whole ecology,
yes,
as human,
uh-huh,
beings, no. As being brilliantly intelligent, sure, I spend fascinating hours in the visiting room, sometimes 7-8 hours conversing with him about the brain and how the brain worked, and how fascinating it was that he felt there were 7-8 circuits to the brain, just like a car has
gears. Uh-huh.
Thank you, gears. As you go on in your life, you shift gears. And, yeah, you shift gears in your brain, and you, yeah.
You know, one of the things I wondered about as I read this book, which, I mean, there's not a page in which you don't talk about drug use. A lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol. And as I read the book, I thought, how did she remember all of these events and conversations? Do you have an explanation for that? Do you understand?
Beautiful question. It's a beautiful question. And I can say, and in my talk, and I can say that I can answer that very well. Yes, for me, all these things were tools for exploration. My exploration was really sincere. And so I have been sober now 30 years. And in those 30 years, I've really taken the time and the self-compassion to examine all of this exploration and to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be my next book.
Yes, you kind of allude to that toward the end of this book, that there's another book to come explaining how you came to terms with all of that. So talk about while Timothy Leary was in prison and you were visiting him as his wife. You were never legally married, but you considered yourselves married.
Right, exactly.
How did you become involved and he with the federal government?
It became evident that as a scapegoat of the government, and like certain Native American people that have been scapegoated and put in prison, he would probably never come out of prison, because they had managed, with the escape and another federal charge, they had managed to put an enormous amount of years on him. And he decided, and that's part of it, the answer to your former question, he decided that the only way he was going to get out of prison was to manipulate the government.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed me to do that. He needed me to be his guided missile and his liaison with the FBI, DEA, etc., etc. And he needed me to scapegoat me after he got out of prison.
He needed you to make you the scapegoat.
To make me the scapegoat. And
so
scapegoat
in other words, he, together, in conjunction with him, you were working with the FBI and the DEA and these federal agents, hoping that by doing so, you were going to somehow maneuver him to get out of prison.
He was going to maneuver himself.
Yes,
to get
but
out
he was
of prison.
Using you.
Oh yeah,
you could
definitely.
Say by telling
yes.
you to cooperate
yes.
with these people and what to do. Go ahead.
I just want to say, but by then, after 3.5 years, he had been in solitary confinement for 2.5 years. I had seen some things, in a certain way, akin to some things that are happening in Guantanamo. I had seen him shaved, head shaved, with scars all over how do you call that?
His skull.
Uh-huh,
scalp, uh-huh.
And I had seen him in a padded cell. I had seen things that nobody should ever see mm-hmm. in terms of torture. And I myself had been treated not like an ordinary prison wife who comes mm-hmm. to visit, but mm-hmm. in a very cruel and an unusual way. So by then, my trauma was so great that there was only one thing I wanted to do, and it was to get my man out of prison and get myself out of this horrendous situation.
Well, you were in prison, too, with him.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm talking with Joanna Harcourt-Smith. She's the author of How I Survived Timothy Leary and... No, I'm sorry, that's the name of your talk.
Yeah.
The name of her book is Tripping the Bardo with Timothy Leary. And she's giving a book signing and talk on Saturday at 6:30 p.m. at Iconic, the coffee shop on Lennis Street, and there is a fee, and you can go on her website and find out about that. It comes with a book, www.futureprimitive.org. So,
and I also want to say, because it's very important to me, people under 25 or even 30, I'll be at the door, would just give a very, very,
a
very small
yeah.
fee.
Okay. So young folks can come in.
Young folks can come in because I welcome them with all my heart. Being adventurers as well.
Right. So what happened when he got out of prison?
When he got out of prison was when I fell in love with New Mexico. They took us in the Witness Protection Program, and we were brought here to Santa Fe, where I'd never been. And to me, it was absolutely heaven. We lived in an A-frame in Pecos, mm-hmm. except that I was no longer the submissive woman who was willing to be only a beautiful object. In those 3.5 years, I had died, although I hadn't been reborn yet, uh-huh. because I was just a massive bit of trauma. But out of this trauma, another woman beyond the bardo was going to be reborn. And so I couldn't go along with the way that he treated me, which was rather condescending, but very appropriate for his time. Just watch Mad Men, you know.
Yes. Yes, he may have been treating you in a condescending way, or a patronizing manner, but that's kind of the way it was at the time.
Exactly. Right.
And so you ultimately split up?
We split up. Mm-hmm. And he went his way, and fortunately for me, I found myself on a boat in the Caribbean. And the beauty of it is that it was a sailboat, and I found myself absolutely surrendering to nature, because there's nothing else you can do when you're sailing.
Yes.
It's surrender to the mother or die.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived on a sailboat for 6 years.
Alone or with someone else?
Well, there were people who came at times, but...
But it was your sailboat.
It was my sailboat, mm-hmm. and, you know, carrying water, I wouldn't say chopping wood, but, you know, learning to fix the generator, which is very... Or to empty the bilges, which on a boat is very important. So, really, it was like this extraordinary school of surrender and merger with what is. And so slowly I began to give birth to myself, not as a product of the society I came from, not as a product of even the schools I went to, and not as a product of the men I was associated with, but truly a woman in her own right.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And so you were there 6.5 years? Is that what you said?
I was. I was, yeah.
And then you came back to Santa Fe.
I came back to Santa Fe. I actually found myself in Philadelphia with about... I'd been thrown out of my family because of all of this craziness that I lived and endured as well. And I found myself in Philadelphia with about $50 in my pocket. Mm. I went to the club where people go who have been drinking too much. Mm. That wonderful place.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. That place.
That place. And I took a job as a short order cook. And once again, I began to learn how you live. Sometimes I call it the extraordinary road to ordinary.
Mm, nice. Mm-hmm. You know?
And so it was a very, it's been a very beautiful road, learning to be ordinary, but yet authentically who I alone can be, and there will never be one again, but yet.
And so how did you come back to Santa Fe?
Well, I always dreamt of coming back to Santa Fe, so when I was 2 years sober, I came here, and I had saved up money, taking coats in restaurants, and, you know, cooking and doing things, very ordinary things. And by the time I had a little bit of money, I came back here and found a little room on Canyon Road. And I always wanted to write. And in the beginning, it was huge because I wanted to write this book, but really I had so much fear and shame and all of it that, you know, basically all I could write was there was a woman one time in some place.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It was a big ocean. Mm-hmm.
You had to work through, you had to process your life yourself before
exactly.
you could write about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So didn't you work in restaurants here and cook and things like that?
I did. And then pretty much what I would call the gift economy started kicking in. Mm-hmm. I mean, people started helping me so that I could, I passed my GED.
Wow, yeah. You had never graduated from high school.
I never graduated from high school. I spoke 5 languages. Uh-huh. So I passed my GED, that was a day of triumph.
Yes, uh-huh.
At community college. Uh-huh. And then I took a lot of classes. I didn't graduate, but I mean, I learned to write mostly from learning to narrow down my life and begin to concentrate. Mm-hmm. And then 9 years ago, I've created this website called futureprimitive.org, and I interview one person a week, a visionary, author, poet, woman, and I put it up online on my website, and it's grown to about 12,000 actual downloads.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like 12,000 interviews?
Yeah.
Amazing.
No, I have 480 interviews, but 12,000 people per month.
Oh, downloading
yeah.
your podcast. Wonderful.
Yeah, so I'm learning and learning and learning.
That's great.
Yeah.
So when you finish this, you know, as I read this book and when I came to the end of it, and you do talk about being sober and the process, I had the sense that in a way this book was a fourth step for you. And for those who are not 12-steppers out there, in the fourth step we take a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves as part of the process of trying to repair our lives. And so now that this is out, that you finally completed it, how does that feel?
Feels fabulous.
Did it feel like that, sort of like a kind of fourth step?
Well, it felt like you're absolutely right. And I will say it felt like a long, useful recapitulation, definitely. Definitely every time that I peeled off a chapter of this book, I peeled off a layer of shame and therefore could become more authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joanna Harcourt Smith is going to be talking Saturday at 6:30 p.m. at Iconic Coffee Shop on Lena Street. and she'll be doing a performance as well. So what's the, tell us a little bit about the performance.
Well, the performance is that I love to talk to audiences, and so I'll be talking not necessarily about the book. I have a few things that I really would like to communicate, and then we'll have some music in between. And really what I'm interested in is giving a voice to the people who are there, because I'd like to hear about people's non-religious mystical experiences, mm-hmm. some of which could be very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had a few of those yourself.
I have.
What's your favorite memory of using LSD, if you have one?
Oh, it's definitely the absolute confirmation of interbeing with all there is. I mean, I from my LSD experience, I totally celebrate your individuality, but I feel immensely confident that we are also...
We are all connected in some way.
Connected and related. Uh-huh.
You know, that's something that people don't often talk about when they're talking about drug use or alcohol use or whatever in their past. There's a tendency, I think, to cast it all in black.
Yeah.
To say it was all terrible and horrible. And in fact, you seem to be able to hold on to those experiences that were meaningful to you.
Well, I think LSD was a very important experience. My uncle, my Polish uncle, was the what called the inventor of the H-bomb. And LSD happening at the same time, Albert Hoffman discovering LSD at the same time, I think is very, very important.
Well, I've been talking with Joanna Harcourt Smith. She has a new book out, a memoir called Tripping the Bardo with Timothy Leary, and it is a trip. The whole book is quite a trip. Joanna's going to do a book signing and a performance 6:30 p.m. Saturday at the iconic Coffee Roasters on Lena Street. It's been great having you. Thanks so much, Joanna.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.